Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
What if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD plus, and that helps you make energy, it helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD plus levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and Niagen. They help your body make more NAD plus even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD plus. Check out Qualia NAD plus risk-free for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD plus. It's what I use. What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial.
Hey everyone, it's Dave Asprey with Bulletproof Radio. Today's cool fact of the day is that scientists have figured out for sure now that your thoughts do control gene expression, and that's actually how your genes turn proteins out or create proteins. And what's kind of impressive is that the original idea for this came from a video game.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's guest on Bulletproof Radio is a really well-known guy, a guy I'm really honored to have on, and it's Kevin Kelly. Kevin is a co-founder of Wired Magazine, my favorite magazine for 2 decades now, and he's currently senior maverick at Wired Magazine, and he runs the Cool Tools website, which is a website that just has access to all sorts of amazing things you'd never think of. Kevin, I wanted to thank you personally for telling me about the 500,000 BTU weed burner that completely outburns everything else, because I've always wanted one of those, and I have weeds that are calling my name. So, and welcome to the show, by the way.
You're welcome. I am so delighted to be here. This is a great privilege, and I am really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, you're such a fascinating guy. It's hard for me to know where to start talking with you because you're one of the founders of the quantified self movement. So we'll start talking there, but you've had your photos published in Life magazine, and you've done an incredible variety of things that are just fascinating. So the real thing I want to tease out in our interview, just all of the questions, is kind of what's powering you? Like how you get the energy, how you do this, where does this come from? But let's start with quantified self.
Well, so the quantified self was something that, Gary Wolf and I started, 6 or 7 years ago. And it came out of actually us noticing that there were a lot of tools being invented, through sensors and things like, you know, Fitbit, and we were wondering, like, how far could this go? Because it seemed like the idea of being able to measure yourself was immensely powerful. And so as these things started to, the first couple came along, we realized that nobody was even talking about them. Nobody was reviewing them to suggest which ones were better. And so we decided that we would do two things. Was we would start a blog and trying to gather this stuff together and put it back out. And secondly, we would have a meetup and just sort of announce to the world that we were gathering all the people who are quantified selfing. And like, we didn't even define what that meant. We just said, quantified selfers, show up. And it's like, let's see who comes. Remarkably, that first session, which was here in this very studio that I'm in, there was about 25 people who showed up and just said, I am quantified selfing. I am measuring myself. And, among those people was this guy who I just heard about, named Tim Ferriss. Yep. So, and there were others who are now very, active in the movement, and they were all doing something or other, tracking things, using technology to help them track and measure themselves so they can understand themselves better. And that is really the genesis of the quantified self. It's not really even something that I was doing a lot of. Mostly that I was interested in the concept and the leverage that this would generate. And so from that day on, we've had monthly meetings in the Bay Area, and they've gone worldwide with large conferences. And so there's, you know, tens of thousands of people who are now involved at some level of not just measuring themselves, but thinking about how we can do that better.
It spawned a whole industry. I remember in 2003, I started working with biomonitoring. I was working with a startup who had a stick-on heart rate monitor. It was a Kleiner Perkins-backed company, and I was a consultant to them. But I designed everything that happened after the signal came off the body. How does it get to the cloud? How does it get processed in the back end? And then what do you do like with the data? And what I wanted to do was video games. And what they wanted to do was cardiac monitoring for outpatient care. And it was such a gap. And I didn't know back then about what you were doing with quantified self. And I think that might have been pre-quantified self, but I would have been at that meeting if I'd heard about it.
Right, exactly.
Because I was like, the first time I went to a quantified self meetup, I was like, oh my God, these are my people. Like, there was 100 people at a loft in San Francisco. And like, this is so cool because everyone's talking about this and they're sharing this the same way that like an early 2600 hacker meeting was like, you know, mm-hmm. going way back to the computer hacking scene. We're like, look, you can do this to the phone company's network and they don't even know.
And
bringing that whole culture into like, you can do this to the human body and like your body doesn't even know that you tricked it. It's something that hasn't been done before, and it's kind of transformative.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were inspired with quantified self to get these people together, pull them into your studio and have them start talking about it. And did you think at the time that it would grow like it has now?
No. I mean, it was a total experiment. There was just, I was certain that this technology was on this inevitable rise to become smaller, cheaper, faster, better. But our own little, you know, meetups and our own little involvement, we had really no idea. In fact, I've sort of been surprised that other people didn't really sort of pile on and try and do it better or faster. But there really was a need to, because we were sort of growing organically. We weren't really pushing it. We were sort of being pulled along. But I think what remains to be seen is the degree to which this will continue going and how far it will go. For instance, recently I've been trying out the idea of wearing one of these little devices called a narrative. Mm-hmm. And it's a camera that was based on the work that Gordon Bell was doing at Microsoft. And it takes a picture every minute or every 30 seconds, whatever you want, automatically, and sends it to the cloud. And then the cloud goes through and it takes out a representative image of the scene that you're in. And it goes onto your phone so you can kind of flick through it and get the highlights of your day or whatever it is that you are trying to replicate. And then the next version of this will do audio and eventually video. That is a quantified self. It's not so much quantification, but it certainly is recording your live streaming. You know, it's this usefulness of it is still, you know, we're still kind of trying to figure out what's it useful for. And so I think we're at the point with the quantified self where it's very clear that it continues to go forward and there's more and more, but it's not really clear exactly to the degree that we want to do, I mean, how much we're going to do it all the time. And there's actually a really interesting tension. And the tension is between how much of this gathering of data about ourselves do we want to be automatic and invisible to us? And how much of it do we want to be aware of so they can change our behavior? And so, you know, there's a certain degree where you just want it all invisible and just collecting data about ourselves. But then, which is really easy and we get it all, but then it's harder to affect changes in behavior if that's what you want because you don't see it. And so there's another aspect where you actually want to have to do something or become aware of it or have it impinge on your consciousness so that it can affect behavior change. Behavior change is not the only reason why we're collecting data, but that is one of the primary ones. And so I think how far we go and where we go next is probably not as clear as what we saw a couple of years ago. And I think rather than the scale of it, I'm much more interested in sort of like the cultural role that it plays. How much do we want to wear the stuff, or clothes, or the Google Glass, or not wear it? And I think that's going to take some cultural education, some time, some etiquette. Like, for instance, you know, when I went to a party, or if I go to someone's house, do I wear it or not? Do I tell people about it? There's still some things we have to learn about this. And I think we can learn it. I think the evidence of cell phone rings shows that we can actually tame these things and evolve social etiquette about what's appropriate and what's not. But that to me is the real interest, is the quality of the next step rather than how widespread it is.
Your point about the usefulness of the data is a really important one. I felt like there was a time in Quantified Self where there was almost like a data fetishism. We're like, I got the data. I'm like, but what did you do with the data? And I studied information systems. I was CTO of Basis, the wristband company. And even then I'm like, I don't really care if I took 10,000 steps because it doesn't change your life to take 5,000 or 10,000 steps. It's not meaningful data. Like, we should even give that to people because it's like useless. But unfortunately it's the easiest to track and people believe if they take more steps that it makes them better people. So, so then you can sell that. And there is some value to moving, but it doesn't correlate to calories. And there's all these technical things about it. But what I learned in the process of working on hacking my nervous system response is this number around 350 to 400 milliseconds. And I'm forgetting the exact name of it, but in the early days of the computing industry, you had to go below this 400 millisecond response time or you didn't have a responsive system. And IBM refined it down to about 350 milliseconds. And it's named after some guy. And when you're looking at creating behavior change, if you have real-time signal processing, which means probably local, not cloud-based, and you can get a signal that says you're doing something wrong within that very narrow window, you can very rapidly, which is why like heart rate variability or this my latest thing, I'm a fan of the Pavlok. This is a new device.
I don't know that one. Tell me about that.
This is, I'm an investor in the company, a very small investor, but more just a supporter of the company. And what it is, it's got electrodes on the back and it talks to your cell phone. If you don't go to the gym, when you said you'd go to the gym, it tells your Facebook friends you didn't go to the gym and it lets them press a button to shock you. Okay. Now, you might say that's incredibly masochistic, right? But it's not. The shock is mildly uncomfortable, but your nervous system hates the shock. But as an adult mind in there, you don't really mind that much. And also the sort of humiliation of knowing that your friends know and they're the ones pushing the button, but you don't know which one did it. It's incredibly motivational for behavior change. So you can create aversion to smoking and you can do these crazy things. So is this really quantified self, or did it go, because it's not just quantifying, it's like doing something. And furthermore, if you locked it on and it was like part of the prison system, like you could do evil things with this. But if you're the guy who pushes the button to shock yourself when you do something you didn't want to do, it's like clicker training a dog. Parts of your nervous system can be trained that way. And I'm fascinated by that.
How does it really hurt, or is it just like a pinch?
It depends on who you are. I do electrical stimulation training. So for me, like I barely feel it, but most people, they swear. Like it's a pretty significant shock for most people, but not enough to cause neurological damage or heart problems or whatever. It's, you know, static electricity and then some, not as much as a dog collar, which really will hurt.
Okay. No, I think you're right. In fact, one of the conclusions about what we know about the quantified self so far is that, in fact, people are horrible. I mean, humans are horrible in terms of processing data or statistics or numeracy of any sort. And you actually don't really want to have quantification. That's not a very good interface. That, in a certain sense, what we want is kind of is to resensitize, to reorganize, to make new senses, to for us to feel these things in ways that we couldn't. So evolutionarily, we have never evolved to be able to kind of actually accurately perceive our blood pressure or our glucose levels. But if we take these devices and then at first we'll quantify them, but eventually we want to kind of reprocess them so that we feel them in a different way, like you were just talking about feeling, you know, a shock. But that's really crude. That's sort of barbaric. But we can do it in other ways where you actually can, maybe it goes to the brain centers or something where you can actually do something about that. That's sort of what the end goal really is kind of bypass the quantification entirely and make it all internal and have the machines do it, but have us feel it or wear it or in some ways embody it. And then, I mean, I think that's where it's going in the long term.
That goes so far beyond quantifying, and that's into that biohacking realm. And I've been fantasizing for like 10 years about having a 3D tongue printer. Well, you know, they have those things that blind people can use, and your tongue has the most things. But if you hook that up to electrodes, your sense of touch is so much better than your sense of hearing. I just finished 7 days of intensive neurofeedback training, where for hours a day I have 8 channels creating sound, or I'm basically running a lie detector against my own brain. And I've done that 8 times because it's really helped me be in charge of my brain. But the feedback mechanism is so crude compared to a sense of tactile stuff. So if my watch was getting my blood sugar, my blood pressure, and it was sending a little signal to somewhere that I could easily pick up, I would have so much more bodily awareness than I've been able to cultivate using my native sensing network, which is pretty crude. It's pretty refined in some ways, but it's not labeled well. So you get these signals, but you don't know what they mean. And teasing that out is a whole lifetime worth of learning. And I'd like to learn that faster.
Did you get to listen to the, I think it was the Radiolab broadcast of Birdman?
Not yet.
So there was a guy who was born blind, not very uncommon. He has no eyeballs, literally no eyeballs.
Oh, the echolocation guy.
Echolocation. Yeah. And he learned, like many born children, born blind children, to click and listen to it. And often, this was a surprise to me, this apparently is often usually discouraged among for social unacceptable, I mean, there was social unacceptable behavior, but he and his mom said, no, he let him go forward, and he learned, even as a kid, to see, literally see with sound. They did some MRIs of his brains and showed that, in fact, the same kind of areas of the brain that we use for vision had been remapped and used for sound, so he could ride his bicycle, he could walk down the street and tell you, there's cars here. I mean, he was seeing. He couldn't see far. He could only see as far as the sound would go. But within that realm of where the sound was, he was literally seeing like you see, but with sound. And that is just amazing. That just shows some of the plasticity that the brain is capable of.
And the brain will change relatively quickly when you stress it. And one of the things that's come across my radar there is that none of the things that change the brain feel very good. So it's like lifting heavy weights. You kind of might get an opiate high when you're done with it, but like you're going to grunt and swear and sweat, and you're going to get that input.
Interesting. Now that's the first time I've heard that. That's a very profound thing that exercising your brain may be like exercising your body in that sense that there's a element of pain that it must hurt a little, that things break. And that's a sign that actually progress is being made. I had not heard that before. That's a very interesting idea.
It's metabolic.
I wonder if, like, you know, people who are struggling, people like myself, who struggle with calculus or other things, that would make a big difference if you were told that at that time, that in fact, if it didn't hurt a little bit, you're not really going to learn it. Cause that's not a message I heard growing up.
I think it should be a message because it's metabolically expensive to grow new synapses. Synaptogenesis or myelinogenesis, the two big processes in the brain, there mm-hmm. you have to have a lot of fat and it has to not be used for some other process. And so, of course, it's going to take, your brain is going to go, could you like think about something else? Maybe think about that attractive woman over mm-hmm. there. You think about those cookies over there. It's going to distract you because it's less mm-hmm. work to be distracted than it is to have to lay down new neural pathways. And so, there should be a push and a struggle. And we tell people, you got to work it out in the gym, but then you're supposed to just effortlessly learn calculus. And maybe you're supposed to fail a few times. And every night with my 5 and 7 year old at bedtime, I tell them, tell me something you failed at today. And then I praise them for it. Tell them, that's good. That means you were trying really hard. And tomorrow mm-hmm. you can turn that into a win and you can tell me how you won. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I want them to just look at failure as like, mm-hmm. that's what it is, because maybe that'll make it so they can lay down new neural pathways better. Or maybe mm-hmm. I'm just messing them up. I sure hope not. But
No. I think the idea of failure is one thing, but you know, I mean, I think there's even this other metaphor, you know, of kind of exercising your muscles and the way that the muscles are built up through the small tears. I mean, we wouldn't say that kind of you're in a gym, you're failing all the time, although in a certain sense you are. But there is a sense in which the hurt that you feel is due to a very positive process. And so we can say the same thing in learning and intellectually, that we will have some hurt, but that is actually a sign, not so much a failure, but actually a sign that there is a positive process happening.
When the brain delivers hurt to your conscious brain, the unconscious brain delivers hurt, it delivers hurt through feelings of failure. And the biggest example of this to me was when I was doing dual end back training. And this is the kind of training.
I don't know what that is. Dual what?
Dual end back training. And it's a kind of training where you're trying to remember something you see, a physical location on a grid, while you hear a letter. And you're trying to remember what position on the screen at the same time you heard something. So it's mixing your visual and your auditory memory. And it looks kind of like a simple challenge. You got a 3x3 grid and you just have to remember what lit up when you were hearing this letter, but it scrambles your brain and it increases. It's the only thing ever that's been shown to increase fluid working memory. So you can actually raise your IQ oftentimes by 10 points in 20 days, wow. Measurable IQ. But I mean, I had a chance right at the beginning of Bulletproof to fly around the world and train hedge fund managers. These guys are like, they control billions of dollars. They're super high performers. They're type A's. And the number of them who would complete 20 days of training was essentially near zero. And the reason for this is after the second time you do this, these enormous feelings of failure and frustration come up. And what's going on is the brain's going, this hurts. I don't want to double my working memory. And I'm going to have to do that if you keep torturing me. So for 14 days, you beat yourself against the software, feeling like a total jerk for even trying this and probably mad at that Dave Asprey guy for suggesting it. And after 14 days, your score just goes da-dunk, da-dunk, da-dunk. And all of a sudden you can remember, oh, that square was lit up 7 moves ago, and I heard the letter E 7 moves ago. But you have to go through the pain. And pain equals, there's something else I could be doing. Anything on earth is better than this right now. And it's that act of overcoming the pain of failure there, in my mind, that finally got me through it.
But, right. And that's actually where teachers become really valuable, is that they can kind of promise you or guarantee you or persuade you that there is something, a payoff at the end, which is something, if you're doing this alone or even reading a self-help book, you don't really necessarily have that assurance. And so it's harder to kind of keep going because you don't, it's harder to believe in a certain sense that there will be a payoff, that it just doesn't continue to hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt. And so when you have a mentor or a teacher who can say to you, look, I've seen 1,000 people go through this, and this is the stage you're at, and you're going to feel really, really terrible right now. But believe me, at the other end of it, over the hill, there's nice valley, and you'll be great.
It's also the role of community, and that's something that you build with Quantified Self. I imagine there are probably thousands of people now who probably wouldn't have kept tracking their data, except they told everyone that they were going to show it the next month at the Quantified Self meetup. So they just kind of stuck with it and kept measuring their food or whatever else that they were doing.
Yeah, it's true. I think community is another, and accountability, some of those kinds of things. That's it. Things like Fitbit and other devices have tried to do with having you to be accountable in certain senses to what you're doing. And I think that's a very powerful, very, very powerful force. And that, you know, that's part of this whole movement to the social dynamics and the social media and the social technologies, which is that, you know, people together can be much more powerful than you alone. And we're just rediscovering that again and again and again and again.
So let's shift gears a bit. And you wrote a really impactful book called What Technology Wants.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And it was widely lauded. And in fact, I have a copy of it on my bookshelf here. One of the, in fact, I think it was Jay Abraham actually told me that I should that I should check it mm-hmm. out, which reminded me to open it up again. And what does technology want? So for listeners mm-hmm. who don't know about that book, like kind of in a summation, what was the thesis behind What Technology yeah. Wants?
So even though technology is pervasive in our lives, there is a kind of a recognition for most people that it's the main driver of culture right now. Most of the things that we're worried about in the world are caused by technology. Most of the problems are caused by technology, as well as most of the new opportunities. And yet, we don't really have a very good theory of what technology is. We have something very similar to the theory of biology before Darwin, which is kind of like, this is one thing after another. Like the biologists would have these curiosity cabinets and they would just put in all these fabulous biological specimens, but there was no framework for understanding how they were related to one another. And technology for most of us is sort of like that. It's, we have lasers and you've got GPS and you've got nanoparticles. It's like, there's this one thing after another. They're all just in your curiosity cabinet. And I set out to kind of try and find was there a framework or was there something that was unified technology that would help us evaluate new technologies when they came along? Because I'm not so crazy myself in trying to have all the latest things. I like to kind of keep a little bit of distance, and I wanted some help in trying to frame all that was happening. And I thought what I would do is go around to all the philosophers and technology experts and interview them and have them tell me what it is, and I'd write a book. But it turned out that there wasn't a theory, so I began to kind of cobble this together. And what I came up with was the realization that basically the same dynamic that runs through this world of technology is the same dynamic that produces us. It's evolution accelerated. It's the self-organizing aspect of evolution. And the way I kind of went after technology was to see it as a system. So you know, there's a pen and there is a flash drive and there's this little camera, and none of these things are alive in any real sense of the word. But if you take the system of the factory that made this pen and the tools that support the factory and the tools that support the tools that have to make the tools that make the factory, that network of all these technologies that are codependent on each other, that depend on each other, that thing itself is almost lifelike. I call that the technium, which is indistinct from technology as singular species. There is this web of this internet, so to speak, of all the technologies in the world, and they're all dependent on each other. None of them can stand alone. So while I could make a stone axe in a weekend, nobody here could make this thing by themselves. Even all your readers together, as smart as they are, could not do that. We have this very large interconnected network of technology, and that is the technium. And that thing not only exhibits some of the behavior that we expect in evolution, but my argument is that it, as a system, like any system, it has its own agenda. It has its own tendencies. It has its own technium, this thing, this network of all the technology we've made, almost at civilization level, itself has a certain tendencies, certain urgencies, certain biases, that when all things being equal, technology will want to go in certain directions. And it does things, and a great example that I might suggest is, you know, current technology of the internet. It wants to copy things. Copying is an inherent, vital, essential, primitive aspect of what happens in digital technology. It wants to copy and make copies of itself. Whenever you, right now we're making multiple copies of this as it goes through the internet. You can't stop copying. It wants to copy. You have to work with the copying. You can't prohibit it. You can't outlaw it. You have to kind of figure out, well, how can we make and reward people for making things, even though copies will be ubiquitous? So that's kind of an example of what I'm looking at and what technology wants. And so I went through and said, well, there's some large-scale trends, large-scale tendencies in technology as a whole, like it wants to continually increase in complexity. So I can make a, and it wants to increase in specialization. So I can make several different predictions that I think are going to be pretty much on, which is that you take any device we have today, and I would say in the future, there'll be more specialized versions of it. Cameras, we continually make, even though we have cell phone cameras, we continue to make more and more specialized varieties of cameras, super high speed cameras, super high speed underwater cameras, super high speed infrared cameras. We just goes on and on and on. And I think those are the kinds of trends I try to look at in terms of what this technology wants. It wants increased specialization, increased complexity, increased mutualism, which means that it becomes more technology becomes on, dependent on other technologies. Also, we become more dependent on other kinds of technologies. It wants to increase in diversification. It wants to increase in energy efficiency. So there's lots of long-term scale things that technology is leaning towards. And my message to the readers, to everybody, is that we should embrace those trends rather than fight them or outlaw them. We should embrace them and try to work with that rather than trying to deny them or prohibit them.
Does that mean that you're a transhumanist?
It does, I think. Because it means that we ourselves are in our invention. We're our first invention. We're the first animal we domesticated. We've made our own humanity. We have made ourselves technological. So we are deeply, deeply dependent on technology. I mean, to the point of cooking has, which is an external stomach. That was a technology we invented that changed our entire face, our jaw, our teeth,
yeah,
our digestive habits when we domesticated animals and milked them. We evolved very quickly, genes for lactose digestion in adults. And we're continuing to do that. And so as we have more and more technological power, we will continue to remake ourselves into something. So humanity is really not a destiny. It's a process. And I would say with the new technologies, you know, from genetic engineering to AI, we are continuing to make us and remake us. And I believe that we're going to make ourselves more human. Because I think when we think about what makes you human, it's just not our hairless bodies. It's the fact that we've remade ourselves. And we're going to, and that is the definition to me of humans, is the animal that has remade themselves. And so I think we're going to keep making ourselves and remaking ourselves. And that's my definition of transhumanism, which is that it's something, a trans that we're in the motion of, we are in the process of. You know, I'm not the transhuman who wants to chop my head off and freeze it and, you know, or download myself into a computer. I'm not eager to do those, but that, but in the broader sense, I think we're going to, continue to reinvent ourselves.
Continued reinvention is something that's a core human drive.
Exactly.
Yeah. I completely agree with you there. And I'm also of the same opinion, and I'll probably piss off some of my good transhuman friends, but I'm not that interested in freezing my body. I'm also not interested in mummifying myself, because yeah. Those kind of seem like similar technologies to me. they're both a quest for, you know, the afterlife or something like that, or quest for immortality. I'm all over the quest for immortality, but I would like to do it in my meat rather than in some vat of frozen stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this can get into another area. I mean, I think there's some fundamental misconceptions about, computation and ability to download ourselves. I think that the matrix the computation works on is actually very, very important. There's a famous hypothesis called the Church-Turing hypothesis, which says that basically all universal computation is universal, so that it doesn't matter what matrix, what substrate you do the computation on is equivalent. Well, if you look at the original theory, it says it doesn't matter, assuming you have infinite time and space. But limited time and space is the definition of reality. And so the problem is that in the real practical terms, the substrate that you're doing computation on does matter. And I think, this is my prediction, that the only way you get really human-like kind of intelligence, which is only one of many millions of kinds, is if you have a very human-like substrate, like a brain. And it says that if you don't have the gray matter, you'll have a different kind of intelligence, which to me is the real value. That's the reason to have AI is not because it can be human-like, but because it can be unhuman-like, yeah, or inhuman-like or alien. And that's the power. We want to have different kinds of thinking. You want to think differently. That's where the power is going to be, because there's going to be problems that we have as a society that we cannot discover or solve with our own kind of intelligence. We need other kinds of thinking. That's what we make AI for, is because it's going to think differently. And so easy to make a human brain that we don't really want a need to do that. If you make a brain that can remember all the things like Google, it's just that by definition is not human. So I think the hope of sort of downloading ourselves into a computer unchanged is a little misguided. I think it may be possible to transfer something, but you're certainly not going to be thinking the same way that you did before.
Yeah, you might be thinking better, but it certainly will be different. So
right.
It's that whole trans, you know, at what point are you like, yeah, well, you're not exactly transhuman, you're like something else. And
exactly, yeah, right.
So you might not maintain your humanity. So going back to Bill Joy's famous white paper when he was CTO of Sun Microsystems, which has since been eaten by Oracle, Bill wrote a seminal white paper that I believe Wired published,
yeah,
probably when you were at the helm. And he wrote a paper about, you know, the coming dangers of technology. And this was long before we had the cloud the way we do today, mm-hmm, and some of the other like 3D printers. And in fact, there's a 3D printer behind me right there. And so are you concerned about some of what technology wants really not being that good for us?
Actually, I'm not in general. I have one or two things that I do worry about. But Bill Joy's article was mostly about an interesting subset of technology, which are robots, computer stuff, nano, and genetics. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about those four are basically those are all the ones that have self-replication in it. So they can self-replicate and self-replicate and self-replicate, and that can kind of rapidly kind of cascade almost out of our control. And so this is something to legitimately be concerned about, because it's not just like making an atom bomb or something. It's making something that can continue to replicate and accelerate in a way that can veer out of our control very quickly. And so and AI, of course, is one of those. And Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and others have raised concern about AI going out of control. And, I think there is a legitimate concern, although I think it's overblown. But we I'm very optimistic about it because we have existence proof already, which is children. Okay, so these things are going to be like our mind children. We can guide and instill in certain principles so that when we let them go, they can be guided themselves and even pass the guidance on. So we know that in theory this can happen. It's a matter of us doing it. And I think actually we're beginning to do that right now and trying to instill, like, say, ethics and morality kind of, so to speak, into, like, say, driver, computer driven cars. They have to make decisions, sometimes make choices. And the interesting thing to me is that by doing this, it's like having children. They make you better. I think we're going to become better ethicists and better in a moral dimension because we have to teach these very dumb computers how to do this. And we're going to realize that we're actually not very good at it. You know, we think that, well, we're superior as we're driving down the street. But, you know, as you know, the old trolley dilemma is like, it's a dilemma. There's no real answer. And we think that we have this all sorted out, but we actually aren't, we're actually very sloppy about it. And I think by having to program another generation of creation to do this, we're going to become better at it ourselves. So that's my one answer to Bill Joy's, where we're going is that I think, yes, I think it is a very big challenge. I think it's a challenge that's good for us because I think it will actually make us better in the process.
That is a very eloquent answer. And I'm still blown away by the number of different projects and things that you've done that have had really broad reaching impact. And I'm torn because we're running towards the end of the interview. And I want to ask you about The Well, which is one of the first intact online communities, really. And you played a hand in that. And I also want to talk to you about Out of Control, your book about decentralized emergent systems that mm-hmm. was the Wachowski, although I say their name probably wrong, the guys who wrote The Matrix, the best movie right. ever, basically cited this as one of the things that inspired them to write the book. So of those two stories, which one are listeners going to care about the most? Because I don't know.
Well, let's talk about Out of Control and The Well and The Matrix, of course. The Well was just briefly was one of the original pioneering online communities, and we started in 84, 85, and I learned a tremendous amount about the online world. And one of the biggest surprises for us was how fast people online really wanted to meet face to face.
Yeah.
And how that kind of virtual relationships really drove physical, real life relationships. And so I was kind of in some ways buoyed by that because I realized that these were not substitutes for the rest of our lives. These were actually augmentations to it. And that was one of the lessons I took about The Well and The Well community.
I was a member of The Well back then, not in 84, but going back to probably 91, 92 mm-hmm. timeline.
So. Yeah. It was still very, very active then. It was almost at its peak. Out of Control was a book that I felt was where it was really trying to deal with this idea of decentralization, decentral control, and how you could make things something smart from a lot of dumb things. And the metaphor that I used was the hive mind, the beehive, that actually has a longer memory than individual bees and is a much more powerful being as a superorganism than the individual parts. And how the emerging internet was beginning to resemble some of those kinds of things. And I think that was the aspect of the book that the Wachowski brothers or siblings were interested in was the third movie where you have this organic swarm thing that was at the basis of their world. And what we've seen playing out since the book's, I don't know, 20, 21 years old at this point, is how more and more of both businesses, institutions, and the net itself is been moving very, very steadily towards decentralization. I mean, that's kind of the big trend in our culture in the last 30, 40 years is this decentralized, is this leveling of the hierarchies into the power of what you can do with a decentralized system. And I want to make one clarification about that, which is that there's a limit. That while Wikipedia is really fantastic, Wikipedia is the kind of, Wikipedia and Uber are kind of the two classic emblems and icons of this. The Wikipedia is better than any encyclopedia that we had before, but it's not the ultimate encyclopedia. And that while the completely decentralized bottom is by far the best way to start anything, and it will always take you further than you think you could go, but it won't take you all the way. Wikipedia itself is beginning to have other levels of hierarchy added onto it. They freeze articles. They do all kinds of things from the top down to make it better. And eventually, in the goodness of time, even the Wikipedia will be some kind of combination of some of the Encyclopedia Britannica high-end editing and the bottom, because you need both. And Uber and all these other ones that are kind of decentralized, they will over time accumulate, you know, vetting of drivers and all this kinds of stuff that come from the top down. You need both to get to where we actually want to go. But the decentralized bottom up will always take you further than you thought you could go. It's always the best place to start. And we haven't yet finished exploring to see how far that will go. And so that's the big drive right now in the world of almost any kind of technology, is how much can you do with this decentralized bottom? And the answer is far more than we thought.
As a technologist, I played a real role in the rise of the data center business model, which is basically mainframes. It's giant centralized data centers. But the last 5 years of my career in tech, I was talking about what I call the ambient cloud, the idea of get it out of the data center. Like, it's much better if all the files are on your iPhone than if you have to download them each time you need them because of this thing called physics and all of this. And what's been the biggest surprise for me as a technologist and to some extent a technology futurist is how slow the decentralization has happened. And the things that slow it down are usually governments and control institutions. So they make really inefficient systems because they want to be able to control them. When you talk about what technology wants and you look at these emergent behaviors, are we going to just break them with regulatory stuff?
Make no mistake that there's going to be a lot of conflict. The established ways of doing things will rebel and fight against and try and stop this. There's winners and losers. And in the legal realm especially, legal is always, you know, playing catch up to technology. We'll always run ahead. I think there's certainly going to be pushback. But I think the real solution to this is actually to continue to decentralize and defragment the lawyer system. Law is really interesting because it's a code. And we know, we, the technologists, we know code. And so, I think, part of what we want to do is actually to try and, accelerate a revision in how we make legal code, in order to try and make it run a little bit faster, because it is way, 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 way behind. But I think that is a friction. I mean, I think that's going to be a friction that'll be around for at least a century. And in a certain sense, what code has always done, legal code, is sort of just fixed what is being done socially. And what we want to try and do is accelerate that process. So we saw that in the copy world, okay? Everybody was copying. And the law just has to absorb the fact that there was a kind of a consensus, a social consensus, that certain amounts of this was okay. And so that has to be brought into the law. But it just takes so long. So we need to accelerate the ways in which we can capture the consensus into law and to make it more flexible. And there's, you know, the sunset guys, and there's many people thinking about how to do this. Laws that have to, that elapse themselves, after a certain amount of period, have to be renewed. I mean, Tim O'Reilly works with the government 2.0. Government is really been ignored, for better or for worse,
and I am one of the people who tend to ignore it, but I really admit that we could do a lot better at devising a way to have governance that works. And it will take, talk about pain, it's going to take a lot of pain to do that, because government's all about resolving inherent conflicts. It's all about compromise. There's just a lot of things, but we can learn how to use technology to help us do that. And so I think that the law will always be behind, but we can actually make it not so behind.
Got it. So the law won't hold technology back for that long.
I think it is always holding it back, but I think we can make it hold it back less.
Okay.
In a certain sense, you want law to be a little conservative.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's okay to have a little bias where it's kind of like saying, hey, wait. But you just have to, we just wanted to, you know, remove a couple of those weights. So it just says, hey, wait, instead of, wait.
Well said. Now here's the really big question that we're getting to, and people who have listened to this whole interview by now know that you're a deep thinker, and you've had an unusually large impact on many different aspects of society, very broad things that are still like way ahead of the curve. How do you do that? Like what drives all of this stuff? Because there are very few people on the planet who can lay claim to the number of things that you've done like this. What's behind that?
That's a good question. Because I'm going to work in one mention of one of my latest projects, which is a graphic novel that we kickstarted 2 years ago. And it's about angels and robots. It's about... a young coming of age story for a young girl who figures out that, the newest conscious robots are going to be ensouled from angels, of which there's a million different species, who want to shortcut the normal process of getting bodies and jump into these robots without being adequately prepared morally or constitutionally. And so, what I try to do is, there are some tricks in people like Brian Eno, someone who I know, has taught me some of these really good rules. And, the thing that I'm always, inspired by, maybe that's the word, is, stories about things that we, thought were true that turn out to be false later on, and things that we thought were false and were true later on. And the ability to change our mind. So in a certain sense, nothing gives me more satisfaction than having my mind changed. And what I'm trying to do is to surprise myself, to change my mind. And that entails kind of constantly questioning my own beliefs and assumptions and the assumptions of others. And so there's a little bit of a, I mean, it's a game, maybe, I guess you would call it, of trying to say, of trying to view things from a different angle. And that's that lateral thinking that they talk about, which for me is just pleasurable. And, so the ultimate motivation is I find a pleasure in learning about things, questioning things, trying to imagine what if, in the way the science fiction writer might. And it's sort of it's a joy. I mean, it's propelled by joy. It's simply the joy of discovery. And that coming in from the angle is actually one of the reasons why I travel a lot, and why I think travel is so important for me anyway, is that I go somewhere far and strange, and by being out and looking back in, it's another opportunity to try and see things from a different angle. Brian Eno has this thing he does with bands. He'll say, okay, band, pretend that you're an African factory and you're making music. It's like, so you suddenly are seeing in a different world. Pretend that you're, and Marvin Minsky does this, another thinker. He's, mm-hmm. He pretends he's a Martian. And he's, you know, he's not assuming anything is true, not the humans are better than anybody else or anything. He's assuming he's a Martian coming in and questioning things as if he was an alien. And I think that is sort of that playfulness, maybe is the word, is what I seek and what gives me pleasure of trying to not take things too seriously, even the things that I believe really strongly, and subjecting them to like, well, what if that wasn't true? What if the quantified self was a total fad? What if technology, what if Moore's Law doesn't run for another year? Then what happens? What if it runs for 1,000 years? It's sort of, it's a playful approach, the stance of fun in a certain sense to that opportunity that we have to try to imagine what could be and not just what is.
Very, very cool. And I was wondering if you'd have a quantified self answer, but I actually monitored what I was doing and I can tell you what makes me tick. But so what I heard there was joy and a sense of playfulness and the sort of continuous questioning from different perspectives are the things that are really motivating you.
Yeah, it is. And and I think that has, you know, and if, for whatever reason, you know, as growing up, I was really interested in art and science, which I think is actually, you know, to me, my wife's a scientist. It's like, you know, if you ask what drives them, it's this kind of curiosity. I mean, it really is. If they, each time they do an experiment and it doesn't work, it's like, well, what is going on? I have to know. I just need to know what is going on. And so a lot of the pursuit can be propelled with money to make like a drug, but in fact, ultimately, it's this curiosity about how things work that really drives them individually. And I think, for me, you know, I couldn't decide whether to go to MIT or to art school because I was interested in art and photography as a, it was a way of investigating the world. And, I think play is underestimated. As a driver and as a prime motivation, and I would like to honor that.
Very, very well said, and incredible to get a chance to ask you that question. We've passed briefly at the Quantified Self conferences and, you know, said hello and all, but not really had a chance to sit down. So what an amazing answer. And there's a question that I've asked every guest, all 200 and something on Bulletproof Radio at the end of the show. And it's, given all of the things that you've experienced and all of your knowledge, which in your case is a very unique set of things, what are the top three recommendations that you'd make for someone who wants to perform better at whatever it is they're here to do? So whatever they want to do, whether they just want to be a better parent, they want to be a better entrepreneur, it doesn't matter. You want to perform better. These are the three most important pieces of advice you have to offer.
The three most important pieces of advice. Okay. Well, one I kind of hinted at already, yeah, which is that I think you are, this was a quote from Tim Leary, which was, you're only as young as the last time you changed your mind. Okay? So to stay young, keep changing your mind. Esther Dyson has another quote, a friend who is a prominent investor and VC funder. She says, keep making new mistakes. And this goes back to the kind of things you were talking about teaching your son's failure. So her contribution was new mistakes. So you make the same mistakes, you want to make new ones.
She's an incredible woman. I pitched her when I was with Basis, and she was so helpful. I was really just grateful for her as a human being. So yeah, good call to quote her.
Keep making new mistakes. And and the third one is a little bit more complicated to talk about, but there was a axiom, something people repeat that is true to some extent, which is this idea of Joseph Campbell's follow your bliss. You want to follow, rather than follow the money, follow your bliss. But I was persuaded of a contrary view by a guy, Cal Newport, I think his name is, who wrote a book called Too Good to Ignore. And what he says is that what you want, the way you get to your bliss is by mastering something. And that rather than that you find your bliss and then you master it, you get to your bliss by mastering something, and that mastery helps you to move towards your passion. So a lot of people, young people, are often paralyzed in the beginning because they don't have a passion.
Yeah.
And they're saying, I need a passion, I need a passion, I need a passion. And they don't have the passion, and they feel like they can't go forward. But in the very beginning, what you want to do is you want to just become so good at something that that people can't ignore you. You really just want to give your heart to something, and it almost doesn't matter in the beginning. Just give 100%. Even if you aren't super passionate about it, just decide that you're going to master something. And in that mastery, you can move yourself to something that you are just passionate about. So mastery is a way to arrive at your passion.
Wow.
And I think that's a much more practical and ultimately satisfying way to approach the possibilities of the world, which is don't kind of wait till you're passionate about something. Begin now with almost anything and try to become so good at it that people can't ignore you about it.
Wow. So I have never heard mastery as a path to bliss out of 200 something people, but what a very eloquent way of putting that. Wow. Thank you for that thought. I've never thought of it, but it makes so much sense just right on its face. So that's a gem.
Yeah. I'm sure your own life, you probably recognize
that. I do.
That
yeah.
You probably became really good at something that is not where you ended up. I mean, it's sort of where you started, but you became so good at it that you could then move into the next state. And I think that idea of that wherever you're going to start, it's probably not where you're going to end. So start by becoming really, really good at something. Put that 10,000 hours in, whatever it is. It may not be where you'll end up with the greatest satisfaction, but you'll get there by that being so good.
Very, very well said. People finish hearing this interview, I'm sure they're going to want to hear more about your work. And normally I can name a URL, tell people where to go, but you've got so many different projects underway. Where should people go to find out more about all the cool stuff that you've got your hands in?
Yeah, so I'm pretty Googleable. Yeah. Actually, my email has been public for 25 years. So kk@kk.org, very easy to find. But my website, kk.org. has a bunch of stuff, cool tools, where we review one and recommend one really great cool tool every weekday. I have a site called True Films where I review the best documentaries, and I've been doing that for at least 15 years. And I'm pretty active on Google Plus for weird reasons, where I actually post stuff and reply. I don't read much Twitter, but I do have, it is broadcasting. So I'm pretty accessible at kk.org. Okay. Anything you want to find out is there.
Kevin,
thanks for asking.
Oh, of course. Thanks very much for being a guest on Bulletproof. And just thanks for all the things you've contributed to the evolution of technology.
Sure.
You've had a meaningful hand in a lot of the things that have been a huge part of my career. So, hats off and thank you.
Well, thank you for the privilege of being here and chatting with you. I am honored to be on your show, and it was a really great conversation. I had such a good time, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing within Quantified Self in the greater arena of technology. More power to you. Keep going. Keep making new mistakes.
Awesome.
Great.
If you enjoyed today's show, you know what to do. Go onto iTunes and click like and tell someone how cool this was. And while you're at it, check out Cool Tools and check out what Kevin's up to, because he's one of the great minds of our generation, at least in my geeky opinion. So have an awesome day, and thanks for listening to Bulletproof Radio.
A Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.